thank Mr. Sobolovsky and Dr. Pelkovitz. Bechlal, the people in YU Connects, it's a very novel and wonderful idea that I hope that you all take advantage of. They've made, Baruch Hashem, so much progress. I think you're the only guys that are not married. And even one or two of you are married, but they're doing terrific work. And we have a tremendous chus to have the Rabbitson and the rest of the chaver there that are thinking about you and working for you, and you should take advantage of that. That's very important. As far as my role in this, I suppose to give some sort of a Torah perspective on a subject that Dr. Pelkovitz could give both the Torah perspective and the psychological perspective. I can't give the psychological perspective, and I'll try to give a little bit of a Torah perspective, so really, he should be the only one that's speaking here. But I'll just a little bit of ha'ora, a little bit to open up. I've discussed individually with a couple of the guys here something that I call the Yogi Berra syndrome. Now, for those of you who never heard of Yogi Berra, which means a few Mets fans who make believe you never heard of Yogi Berra, he was a great catcher for the New York Yankees and had a special way with words. He never intended to sound intelligent, and he isn't particularly intelligent, but he said some very insightful things, kila achayad. And one of the things that I remember reading from Yogi Berra was he was having a terrible batting slump, and he was normally, I think, a 280, 290 hitter. Is pretty good, even sometimes 300. And they took him out of the lineup, and they had him work for a couple of weeks with the batting coach, very intense work with the batting coach, who was talking to him and explaining to him, he's got to move his arms like that, he's got to look like this, he's got to move his, you know, he has to do certain things that he hasn't been doing right, which have caused him to fall into a terrible urethra, into the slump that he was going through. And Yogi was a very good student, and he was listening and this and that. And finally, they put him back into the lineup in the Yankees, and it was worse, mamish worse than ever before. It was terrible. And I recall reading that a reporter asked, hey, Yogi, what's going on? You had the best batting coach in the world training you and teaching you and talking to you for the past couple of weeks, and you're not touching the ball. So Yogi Berra said a very simple thing. He said, I can't think and bat at the same time. I can't think and bat at the same time. I had a certain natural swing. They totally messed me up. I was in a slump, but I can't come out of it with somebody else's way of thinking. I have to get back into the natural swing. Now, the reason I often mention that to guys is because it happens that most of our clientele here in the yeshiva, most of the chevra, in an earlier Gilgul, before Eretz Yisrael, or whenever you began to think that there's a Kodesh Baruch Hu, that many of the chevra here in the yeshiva have some past experience of speaking to young ladies. I'm not asking you to raise your hands to show that you have. Speaking, or maybe not speaking, texting, or something like that, but having what we call in the vernacular epis ashaychus, some sort of a shaychus with the girls, and there was perhaps some sort of a natural swing that you had, being able to communicate with that gender, and as a result of upgrading Bez Hashem, your learning, your Yerushamayim, and maturing, you have moved on to the next stage in life, and now a very strange thing has happened. From the earlier years when you were Yogi in his prime, and things were going well, and you had that natural swing, and you knew how to speak to the girls, and you were comfortable in that world, then you entered into the frum zone. The frum zone then reminded you, hey, you're talking about the Rices, Drabonins, Rambans, Rambams, you're in big trouble, you better stop all of this stuff, absolutely, cold turkey, nothing at all. And then all of a sudden you reach a certain age and everybody's telling you, this is a big mitzvah, you better start again. This is a huge mitzvah, you got to get married, you know, and you have to know how to talk like a mensch, to act like a mensch, you have to. And then here we are, and we're going to begin to give you, and you're getting some tips, and you read some books and manuals about how to swing. And I mean, you understand figuratively, and how to get back into the swing of things, I guess would be better. And you just, you know, you feel like you've lost it, and you can't think and bat at the same time. I mean, do this and don't do that, say this, don't say that. I had a daughter of mine that went on a date years ago. She went on a date, and the fellow went to the bathroom a lot, He kept on going to the bathroom, so all they had was something to drink in the hotel lobby, soda. She couldn't understand what was causing such complications. But apparently he would go in every few minutes to hear from his mom, to get a couple of words of encouragement and advice from mommy. Didn't marry that guy. And as a result of moving on, Baruch Hashem, with your Yiddishkeit and with your Shemayim and your desire to do the right thing, that which was somewhat natural and comfortable has become a bit frightening and intimidating. So let me explain a little bit ba'omik for just a very few minutes. There are two lo tovs in life. Lo tov. There are two not goods. Two lo tovs. The first is at the very beginning of Chumash, which you all know. Lo tov heyos ha'odam levado. It's not good. Lo tov, it's the not good of life to be alone. Lo tov heyos ha'odam levado. Hashem Yisbaruch creates Chava. Lo tov heyos ha'odam levado. The pain and the loneliness that already many of you are feeling. We have these conversations privately all of the time, and it's natural and it's healthy. Hashem Yisbaruch wants a young man, by the time he reaches a certain age, I mean not when you're 13 or 14, but by the time you're mature, that there should be a feeling of emptiness, there should be some feeling of loneliness, that it's time to move on to the next stage. Now everybody knows that, and everybody feels that lo tov heyos ha'odam levado. But there's another lo tov that's not as well known. And the second lo tov is in Mishlei Perek Yutes. And there, Shlomo Melech says, "Gam b'lo das." Listen carefully. "Gam b'lo das nefesh lo tov." Gam b'lo das nefesh lo tov. Let me explain. I think everybody here knows that das, that midah of das, if you're more advanced in your learning of certain svarim, the sphere of das, that koach of das, means the ability to connect. It means the ability to connect, to make a kesher. That there should be a chibur, but the chibur, the connection, is on such a level of nefesh benefesh. Really, one soul to another soul, where there's a bris that's made between two people. It's emes, it's real, it has depth, it has meaning. Now, many, many, many couples go out, and there's a meeting of the minds. And there is some sort of a kesher that's made on an intellectual level. And they share many things in common, obviously. There are many things that they share in common. And as a result of that, there is some sort of a kesher that's made in seichel. God forbid, sometimes there's a kesher that's made in physical ways. Hashem yirachem v'yishmor. And oftentimes people get married coming off of a kesher of seichel, where there was an intellectual connection, or God forbid, a physical connection of some sort, and they find themselves in a marriage that has not resolved the deep existential problem of lo tov heyos ha'odam levado. And there's a terrible feeling of loneliness that many, many married people have in the world, a terrible feeling of loneliness. Even though there was some sort of a connection, there was a connection on some level, and yet in marriage, since it was not a connection where there was true das, gam below das, nefesh lo tov. Gam below das, nefesh lo tov, were taught in the Chassidish Sforim. Gam below das, nefesh lo tov means that in order for the das to change that state of lo tov, it has to be with nefesh. It has to be with great emotional investment. Nefesh benefesh, a true chibur, a true connection. Now we're taught in this Svarim that there are three shlavim, there are three stages in every relationship. In a relationship that bears fruit, there are three shlavim. There's hiskashrus, there's chiba, and there's ahava. Hiskashrus, chiba, and ahava. Now, I really would like to explain this for a number of hours. This is a very big topic, and each shlav here needs to be understood in a very deep way. But l'inyaneinu, just a little bit of a taste of what this means. When a couple is going out, when it's that period of time that's called dating, before there's a hachlata, before a decision has been made, before a decision has been made to actually move towards planning an engagement and a chuppah. It's that time when you're getting to know each other, and there's a turning of some corner, and you're beginning to feel comfortable with that person, you're beginning to feel that you have epis ha-shayches to that person, there's something there. At that early stage, before, remember we're talking about, before either of them are at a point where they're ready to give themselves over till 120. They're not yet ready for that. They haven't made that decision. So at this point, they're still testing the waters, and I guess we would call it becheskas aroi. It's still becheskas aroi. It's not yet, they're not yet ready for a diras keva. They're not yet ready to get married and to spend their lives together. But there is already a certain kind of a sense that something is happening, something is developing. There's a moshul that one could use to explain this state, and which helps to understand much of the agony that you guys go through if you have been in this predicament. And I think a very simple moshul would be, let's say you're schlepping around with your suitcase and you were given a place to stay for a short time. You don't know when you're going to have to leave. Let's say you're on a waiting list for a flight that's supposed to leave. You don't know exactly if it's going to be that night, or you might have to just spend the night, and you're not going to leave till the next day. So you have your suitcase, and you open up your suitcase, and you begin to take out some of the items from the suitcase. You might take out a rope. You might take out your slippers, or pajamas, maybe pajamas. You're not sure. You're not quite sure. But you take out some of this stuff, the real important things, the things that are more chashuv, they're most likely are going to be kept inside, talis and tefillin and so on. Those things are going to be kept inside the suitcase. You're not taking them out yet. And the reason that you're not taking them out yet is because hovering over you is that fear or that hope that at any second this status might change, this situation might change, and that all of a sudden you're going to have to run out of this room, you're going to have to dash to the airport and get on the next plane. So because of that, you're dafka not going to take out those chafotzim, those objects that are nearest and dearest and most precious to you. They remain buried deep in the suitcase because you're not yet in a place that's settled. This has to do with the headlights that the Rebbe was talking about. The brights, turning on your brights too early, but also the problem of not turning on your lights at all. Now what happens here is the same way that a person has their suitcase and he doesn't take out the most important things that are most personal because at any moment he might be packing out, so too when you're dating, you're going out with somebody, you're beginning to care for each other, you're beginning to find some things in common, you're not yet at that stage of gam b'lo das nefesh lo tov, nefesh b'nefesh, you haven't come to that point yet, you're not there yet, and therefore it's natural that those hargoshes, those emotions, those feelings, those fears, those dreams, some of the secrets, maybe of your own life, of your family, and so on, you're not ready to take out of the suitcase, and you should not at that point take out of the suitcase, because there are certain things that should not be taken out, sometimes not till 120, and they should go down with you at 120, and if they are going to be taken out, they should only be taken out when you've actually gotten into the home with your wife, and you're in a diras keva with that person you're going to be spending the rest of your life with. So there are cheftzei halev, we can call them. There are objects of the heart. And those objects of the heart are carefully guarded until you're ready for that point of life that's called ahava. Alpi chassidus and alpi Torah, ahava really is a stage that's only to be discovered and uncovered when one is in a relationship that is Bez Hashem permanent. Ahava. When one understands what ahava is, I'm not talking about what it means here to people, the way that the word love is used and the way that it's thrown around, but ahava pnimis, amitis, where there's a bris of nisuin, so that we know that it says by Yitzchak that he only loved Rivka after they were, vayikach, and only afterwards vayaver. And the same thing it says by David HaMelech, even when it comes to dear friends, it says v'nefesh Yohanesan nikshura b'nefesh David vayehavehu. First there's his kashrus, then there's ultimately ahava. So now what do we do during that time when you're in between? In other words, you're already feeling some hiskashrus, and with this I'll end, there's already a feeling of hiskashrus. You do feel a kesher. You feel some strong kesher to this person. There's a certain chayn. There's a chayn in how she speaks and in what she says. You discuss certain things in hashkafa. You talk about certain sensitive topics, being careful with your cheftzei halev. They're in the suitcase, but you're taking out a couple of the things that are there, and there is some sort of a kesher. What is there in between? So here, Dvar HaKadoshim discuss chiba. Chiba means affection. Now here's where the guides run into a lot of trouble. Because as Jews who are observant of halacha, and as serious young men who want to do the right thing in God's eyes, but at the same time, you don't want to spend the rest of your life alone. So it becomes very confusing. Exactly what can I take out from my suitcase? What am I allowed to be megala? Now, there are some people that simply, they are naturally or emotionally, they find it difficult naturally and emotionally. Bechlal could even be with male friends that they feel it's difficult to take out cheftzei halev. Now here's where things become complicated. We're learning now the parashiyos of the Kruvim, and the Kruvim faced each other. And I've spoken many times, many of you have heard shiurim from me on the subject of panim al panim. When Hashem gave us the Torah, He gave it to us panim al panim. There are some young men who have a hard time even looking in the eyes of a young lady. And again, I'm only speaking in a way that's sanua, with tremendous chachm, and I can't go into prote protim with a tzibur. You can't discuss these things with a tzibur. What's considered to be tzanua, and what's, God forbid, what's not considered to be tzanua. But when Hashem is Baruch tells us, v'shavta ad Hashem alokecha, and when He says in criticism of us through the Navi Yirmiyah, ponu elai ora, if you turn your backs to me, the Sfarim say the relationship of panim al panim, and there are relationships of achor ba'achor, face to face and back to back. That means that unless you find a way, and you might need help with this, and there are wonderful people here, and friends and family, I hope, people who have experienced and who are wise, that can help you with this, but you're going to have to learn how to be able to show affection as God-fearing young men, to be able to show affection, to be able to come to a point where there is some degree of gilui halev, where you're not turning on the brights, but the lights are on a dim, but you're able to show enough chiba, where through that chiba, through that show of affection, the mutual affection, the chiba can lead to a feeling of hischayavus, of a chiv, of wanting to commit my life to this person. Sometimes when people talk about subjects that are deeper and more pneumistic without speaking about each other, they can touch upon certain things. There are many other techniques and other things that can be done. But the bottom line is that there's something that's called chiba. Chaviv in Yisrael. Chiba yaseir no das. Chiba yaseir no das. But at the end of the day, and I'll turn the mic over to my dear friend, to Dr. Palkovich, at the end of the day, in order to move from that state of hiskashus and chiba, to get under the chuppah, from hiskashus chiba to ahava, to the chuppah, and onwards, there has to be, a certain chalal hapanui, there's going to be an empty space. And that empty space, which is bilti noda, which, when guys are always asking me, but Rebbe, how do I know? So what am I supposed to say? I didn't know. How does anybody know? How did I know? How do I know that this is the right one? You're all maminim, you're big boys. Hiskashus, chiba, hashkafis, being able to take out some of the chefzei halev in a tzniyazdik way, in an appropriate way for a bentari yirei shemayim, which is not so pashut. As far as knowing what's going to be, it's Erev Purim, and Purim is what? Is Adaloyada. Purim is Adaloyada. I'm not telling you should drink on your date, God forbid. But what I am telling you is that there's going to be an empty space of lo noda, of ad lo yada. And that requires a certain leap of faith, but an intelligent, educated, wise leap, so that it shouldn't be an abyss that separates between yourself and the other, but a very little space, a space that's filled with holiness and the light of a true Yirei Shemayim. And Mitzvah Hashem, you'll all be able to make that connection from Hiskashvus, Chiba, Ahava. Not like it is in the world, what they say, we used to sing when we were kids, first comes love, and then comes marriage, b'chulu. But first comes his kashrus, chiba, and then Be'ez Hashem, it should be an ahava, but an ahava that's unbreakable, that's a bris till 120 years.
Okay, so, okay. What I love about this job is I get to hear a whole different way of looking at things, and particularly value and respect and admire the depth of Rav Weinberger's thoughts. I was thinking about the Kruvim. I was at a conference last week, and the other guy speaking was Y.Y. Jacobson. And he was talking about, where's the first place in the Torah that you see Kruvim? Anybody? That's right. So there, Rashi says that they were malachei chabola, angels of destruction. Okay, and where Jacobson was asking, what's the difference? How could you have an entity called Kruvim being called Malchei Chabol, and then the opposite, a Pnei Mishalachiv, you know, wings stretching high. He says it's all about the context. It's all about the context. The Kruvim are all about context. What led to the downfall of man with that chait was the context was one that unleashed Malchei Chabol. So connection could unleash a very different process than the Pnei Mishalachiv, which is what we're talking about with these three levels. I was asked to speak about something you never asked me to speak about before, okay? Which was more about, also about mindset. You know, how do you develop a healthy mindset without getting into a state of yish? And how do you develop that Yogi Berra approach? I was sitting next to somebody on a Shabbos lunch or a scholar in residence in Florida last month, and the guy told me he used to own, I don't know who he was, probably a famous guy, but I don't know that much, as much as I should. He was telling me about, he used to own an NBA basketball team. I forget who it was, I'm showing my amoratsis. But he said the first thing he discovered when he bought the team was that in the league, they had the worst rate of being able to take shots from the foul line. You know, what were the penalty shots? No, right? What's the
foul line,
okay. They were excellent. They were excellent in terms of when they weren't thinking about it. Just sort of like their accuracy was top in the league when it was just, when they didn't have to think. The second they had to take a shot from the foul line, they totally lost it. When these huge NBA players had their hands in their eyes, so that they were blind, they were unbelievable. The second they had to think, it was finished. So he hired a psychologist. That's why he was talking to me about this, he said. And with the help of the psychologist, they made it into the playoffs for the first time like in 20 years. And, you know, he said as long as they had that psychologist, then he was forced to sell the team because of some clause in the contract, and they didn't keep the psychologist on, and they started to fall down again. That's how important it is to figure out how to follow the wisdom of Yogi Berra, right? Which is how to know when not to think, how to know when just to be. You know, this study that came out in Science Magazine in July of this year, they take people, they put them alone in a room, they take away their cell phone, they say, just be. Be alone with your thoughts. Think about your life. It's for no more than 15 minutes. And it drives people crazy. Because people, they forgot how to be. But then the study becomes amazing. They set up electroshock machines in the room. And they tell the people, it's totally up to you. If you want to be on your own, just be alone with your thoughts. Fine. You're going to be here for 15 minutes. There's nothing else to do. Because there literally is just a chair and a desk. And now the electroshock machine. Mild electroshock, not too painful. So they say you could either be alone with your thoughts, no pressure whatsoever. If you get really bored and you want to, you could give yourself a shock. Do you know that 64% of the men and 25% of the women chose to give themselves shock rather than to be alone with their thoughts. Okay? So we have to cultivate the ability to be. And the ability to be in a connected way, eye to eye, p'nei mishal achiv, in a way that you're really mindful. The problem is it's a paradox. Because if I tell you to spend the next half hour not thinking of a pink elephant, you're going to think of a pink elephant. It's very hard to get into that place where you go on automatic for exactly the reasons I was going to talk about. That here suddenly you're unleashed again. So you go from whatever was happening in high school to the new you with learning, and now suddenly you have to turn on again in a more controlled way the desire to connect at these different levels. It's not so simple. So I want to make two or three points on mindset. And then I think the most important thing here is after we hear I always love listening to Reb Sobolewski, to her wisdom. But here's the first thing. Number one is any time you go from threat to challenge, it's a game changer. If as you get ready to go out, you say, I can't believe I'm doing this again. And I can't believe, I remember those days, you know? Like, you know, it could get you nervous. It could start to feel old. It could start to feel stale. It's not an easy unpacking process. But to the extent that you could develop a mindset from threat to challenge, it really makes a difference. I spent this Shabbos at High Lifeline Retreat. It's my favorite Shabbos of the year. It's my most intense Shabbos of the year. It's a Shabbos where I'm nonstop talking to people whose children have cancer, and there are all these very, very sick children, some who clearly are at the end of their lives. It's hard to imagine why it's a Shabbos filled with simcha, but it's tied to connection. And the wisdom I hear from all the people I spend Shabbos with is encapsulated by what one of the Rabbanim said that was a game changer for many of them. He just said a simple thing. He told them, look, you always have a choice on how to view the challenges in life. He says, think of the ayol nechas basfach in the Akedah. You could see that ayol as stuck, or you could see the ayol as positioned. And that's exactly what psychological research shows. The second you see yourself, look, I'm not stuck here. This is a challenge. I could go with the flow. I could just be and allow my relationship with this person to bounce off in a way that I just allow her way of thinking in. And you don't have a mindset of allowing yourself to get frustrated and constantly be overthinking, which gets in the way, you know, hurry up and have fun never works. That's the first thing, is just to talk about. Just a fascinating little talk I had with somebody Friday night after I gave a talk there. Father comes over to me and he says, I got to tell you something that you could only understand by coming to a High Lifeline retreat. He said, my daughter has been very sick. She has leukemia. She had, you know, a year of active, really amazingly stressful and painful treatments. And he said, and finally, she regained enough strength to go back to school. And she's independent. She's a 10-year-old girl. He said, this last week, she went back to school. It's like a nest. He says, it was unbelievable. So my wife and I wanted her to feel like she was independent. We hid behind the building, and we watched her every morning get on the bus, and we were crying hysterically, tears of joy. He said, because I understand, I have a gratitude, an akar sato, for what really matters. Just imagine how the mind works, that you could view something as simple as getting on a bus, something as routine, as the most profound spiritual event that you've ever experienced. The mind is an amazing, amazing instrument that you really have control over. So a couple of thoughts about this from a practical standpoint. Number one is, one more thought. You want to hear one more thought? This is like, for some reason, this hit people, and I can't even say Pashe Mamro because I forgot the Rav who spoke. I was meeting with people, and I ran in. I just heard this as I ran. It was meant for me to hear this so I could share it with you. It's the Chazon Ish evidently said, and it seems so simple, but it's so apropos to what we're talking about. He says, in the Bruch of Hanosein LeYoiv Koach, that we say every morning, we'll said it this morning, we're not asking that we not be tired, which I find fascinating. We're not asking that we not be tired. Just being tired is fine. It's part of the process. What you go through when you start to get a little burned out from dating and maybe having a hard time. So what we're asking for is koach. Since we have no right to ask to not have the fatigue, we're asking for koach. And that's a different kind of thing. It's sort of like, it's a very interesting, subtle distinction. Okay, let me get to tachlis and then I'll be quiet. Okay, you ready? Here's tachlis. Number one is in terms of the power of developing optimism, the power of learning how to discipline yourself to focus on maybe like a feeling that everything will work out. You convey that in ways that you can't even imagine. That in recent research, it just came out, weirdest research, they take rats. These are normal rats. They're pre-tested to be the most average rats in terms of running through a maze. So you have, let's say, 100 rats, exactly average in their ability to be fast. And half are randomly assigned to be handled and put into the maze by people who were told that these rats are genetically bred to be Olympic-level speedy rats. And the other half are told these are regular rats, okay? That's all that these people are told. And all they do is they take the rat after being told this and they put it in the maze. And they find, time after time after time, that a person who's told that this rat is fast, those rats consistently are faster than the rats who the handler believes are average rats. How do you convey that? Well, we're beginning to understand now that the Kamayim Apanim El Panim, the way we bounce off each other, and the way we convey expectations is subtle but incredibly powerful. What must happen, they think, is when you believe that the rat is really fast, you handle it in somewhat of a different way, in a more respectful way. As you gently place it down, expecting it to do its magic, you somehow convey trust in the rat. I know this sounds bizarre. This is like well-done research. It's a little scary. The nimshal is a terrible nimshal. Chas v'shalom, but the nimshal should be to rats. The nimshal here is that if your expectations are optimistic and more positive, and you have a belief in yourself, right? Remember the Rabbeinu Tzadok? K'shem shesor chodom laman b'ashem yisparach chachsor chachar kach laman ba'atzmo, right? You have to believe in yourself. Rasalomar sheyesh l'kadosh baruch hu esek imo, shenen po bata shebein laila hayo vein laila abad. It's an essential component that to be ready to really enter into a relationship, you have to learn to believe in yourself. You have to have that confidence. And you have to convey that sort of like belief that maybe this could work. Because you're in all kinds of unconscious ways getting that out. And part of it is the optimism. Optimism really gets conveyed. Quick study. Seligman takes his graduate students at Penn, and he gives them the speeches given for the last 100 years by the winner of the Republican presidential nomination every 4 years, and the winner of the Democratic nomination. Strips it of identifiers. You don't know whose speech this is. And he has the graduate students rated for optimism. Turns out, the ratings for optimism predicted who won that election over the last 100 years far more accurately than the polls. The power of people believing in you when you believe in yourself and when you convey that optimism. Okay, that's recommendation number one. Recommendation number two is exactly what we just heard from Dr. Sabalowski, exactly what we just heard from Rav Weinberger, is you have to manage expectations. It's very important to understand it does take time sometimes. It does take time, and you just have to let it be to a certain extent. When you manage your expectations and you say, well, this is what's supposed to be happening, and I'm not going to feel intense feelings right away. I just need to get to know this person. And then at a later level, when you're going to the next level, to risk overcoming the natural instinct of guys is not to disclose, is not to talk about emotions. It's sort of like not the way you're socialized and not the way yeshiva education trains you to be. But to risk disclosing a little bit more about yourself than you're used to, all the research shows that deepens the connection and it deepens any kind of relationship to bring it to the next level. And then one final point, and then I'll end. It's that sometimes I find that the guys here, the guys everywhere in the from community, have a hard time conveying when they like the person. Sometimes they do it too much, sometimes they do it too little. So I'll share with you the story, and with this I'll end. You know the story about me and Lonnie?
Yeah.
Okay. Story of my own marriage. I've been blessed, Baruch Hashem, with Leah and Hara, a wonderful, wonderful marriage for a bunch of years. And here's the story. I started going out with my wife. I was set up by my brother-in-law. And we went out for four or five, six times. And it was nice. I liked her. We had fun. But it wasn't going anywhere. And I was involved in whatever it was. I was writing my... But whatever. I was going to Penn, where Seligman was, and I was writing my doctorate. And she was involved in doing whatever she was doing. And we just, it was nice, but there was no connection. There was no, it just wasn't going. So we stopped going out. 6 months later, well, I'm not finding anybody, she's not finding anybody. And I get a call from the person who ended up being my brother-in-law, Shadchan. He says, you know, Lonnie is, she really wants to go out with you again. She feels that she wasn't ready yet, but she really wants to give it another shot. She really likes you. Okay? And then he calls her and says the same thing. Okay? And then it took off. And we get engaged, and he has us over, you know, to celebrate this shidduch that he made. And he says, he takes out, having a little l'chaim, he says, boy, am I a liar. Boy, am I a liar. But it's an amazing, amazing lesson for me. Because it wasn't fake, it was real. It brought us out to the next level. And a lot of it was the confidence I had in knowing she's not judging me, she really likes me, I may be an idiot, I may be saying stupid things, I may be overthinking, but you know what? She likes me anyway. And she thought the same thing about me liking her. And it worked. All the predictors that I usually talk about, those have to be in place. I'll just end real quickly with the short lists, right? Short lists. In Pilmer's, this guy looks at 1,000 old people. They ask what works and what doesn't work after 50, 60, 70 years of marriage. Here's a short list. You have to find somebody where you know you're going to be able to give 100-100. You don't want a relationship where you're giving 50-50. You want to marry somebody eventually who you really like. You want to be with them. You want to marry somebody who's going to bring out the best in you. Okay? Looking at Gottman's research, 6-1, okay? Should be 6 positive interactions for every 1 negative interaction. It's fine if you fight. You have to fight well, but if what's dominating is fighting, and it's 6-1 in the other direction, all the longitudinal research shows that's no good. Most importantly, you have to marry somebody who you could share a vision with. You could see being at their side, Pnei Mishalachiv, sharing a life together, having common values, not completely common values, and it's not going to be identical. It's great if you enjoy the same things, but it's also even better, something called self-expansion. If she brings out a part of you that you've never developed, and vice versa. And I'll just end with the beautiful thought of the Tiferes Yisrael, and Yevamos writes that the Hebrew word nesuin has embedded in it a very important lesson that you need to keep in mind if things aren't going so smoothly in terms of keeping with it with the right mindset. He says, the inevitable difference between men and women could either be a masa, it's embedded in the word nesuin, it's a masa, burden that weighs you down, or it could be a masa. You know what else the word masa means? If you look at Nach, it's a song, something transcendent. It's a nes, something that will fly you high. So to the extent that what marriage is all about is being at each other's side and transforming the inevitable mass of it never being perfect, it can't be perfect. That's not what the SLOAs or Connecto is about. It's about transforming the masa into a soul. So, okay?
So, I'm going to ask the boys if they have any questions, but I want to just ask the question first, if that's okay. If Rav Weinberger and Dr. Hoffman could share some, if someone's going after two or three topics, do you have any recommendations of topics of conversation that you feel that would help bring them to the next level? I mean, can we say, you know, exposing ourselves or telling secrets or sharing more? Sometimes we struggle with tacos, like what is that?
Can I just quickly share something? Sure. The New York Times just had an article about that it was a bed. There's a guy, Dr. Aaron, that does research on relationships. And he said, I could predict from my research how I could almost set something up that will guarantee the two people will fall in love. So part of it is looking in each other's eyes nonstop for, I think, 5 minutes. Don't try this at home, okay? And then 36 questions. 36 questions to deepen the relationship. And it's again, I would not try that. You can't be that formulaic. I have it. I'll have to send it to you. Okay.
No, if you remind me.
You saw it. Yeah. So I have it on. You know, I have it in my pocket. Okay. In my device. But some of the questions that I think, before I give it over to Weinberger, that I think are very important to ask, because sometimes people don't ask these questions, is how do you imagine? How do you picture your Shabbos table? In 10 years, when God willing you're married and you have children, what does Shabbos feel like to you? Okay? Ask them other deepening questions. Is what's the bumper sticker of your family? What does it take to be a hero in your family? What does it take to be a villain? And how do you want your family to be different or the same in terms of what you grow up with? And there's like some families, the bumper sticker is chesed or else, the bria chetichon of last week's parsha, okay? The center pillar of chesed made out of the tree that Avram, you know, sat under. For some people, it's learn Torah or die. For other people, it's Ivy League school or else. Find out what are the passions, not just of her family, but the passions in terms of the visioning towards the future. What are her goals and aspirations? Remember Mishlei, be'em chazon yifara'am. You have to have, without that vision thing, you fall apart. You need to understand it, and you need to see if you could be at each other's sides. And it doesn't have to match perfectly, but it has to be something that you feel that you could pull into. Those are just a few questions that I just came off the top of my head, but let's hear it, yeah.
I'm just going to, just to add to what Dr. Pelker was saying, is that, of course, that's really what a person dreams of and what a person wants to be, what a person is aspiring to be, and is usually the way to identify who that person is in the present. We're all handicapped in certain ways, but what the person wants to be. Reb Sadik said an interesting thing. It was quoted before. Reb Sadik says, "Pnimius ha'av bebein." It means the inner essence. This could be disconcerting to many people, but the inner essence of the father is somehow it becomes revealed through the son, through the child. And an Adam Gobel, based upon that, Rabbi Sadik once said that when it comes to, if we're talking about a topic, when it comes to trying to make a decision, you're going out with somebody, he said that based upon this, if you could try to imagine that this is a person who you would want raising your children, in the ideal world and vision that you have, is this somebody that you would want to raise a family with? Somebody that you could picture as being a mother of your children who don't exist yet? The pnimius of who you are, which you often are not, you feel that you're not qualified to bring out in your own life, but you certainly aspire to see that in your children's lives. That's usually a very strong indicator of whether or not this is an individual that you should be spending your life with. As far as topics are concerned, I've just found practically that sometimes it does work to learn something inside. I don't mean to have a charusa date, but to discuss something fascinating that you've learned as a way of making it more comfortable to lead to a conversation of the nature that Dr. Palkos is talking about, which you might not have the right line or the cue to be able to begin in that conversation, although you should at this point in your lives. But if it's difficult, then by discussing a concept or something that you learned or something that you are learning that touches you in a very deep way, it's interesting to see, is that person also affected by that which affected you so much? If it's an Indian that you feel very, very moved by and very inspired by, and that person seems to be completely unmoved or even uninterested, it usually is an indicator of a problem. And when there's something that moves you very deeply, you would like to see that as a way of opening up the other person and being able to go on with the conversation regarding these topics.
Quick question.
So anyone wants to pass up cards? Go.
Regarding this idea of opening up, but from the Torah's perspective, it has to be in an appropriate way, right? So, I mean, it just seems a little fuzzy to me, but especially with regard to the fact that I can imagine, I'm a layman, not a scholar, that there's a different way that a man should open up to a woman, and then on the other hand, there's a way that a woman should open up to a man. So, like, I feel like that's just an initial question I have because it's so vague at this point, and I feel like maybe that's like a good way, you know, to open up.
So more specifically, you're asking, what exactly is it that you're asking?
To go a little bit deeper maybe into this notion of what is the appropriate way? Is there some guidance? Okay, I understand. Once there's some like sort of feeling that you want to commit to a person, it's become a little bit more real to you, to people, that there needs to be some level of openness, right? Not everything.
That's right.
What we talked about. But it sounds big. I know it's a very circumstantial thing, but there definitely clearly has to be a difference of a way a man opens up to a woman and a way a woman opens up to a man once things are getting more serious.
There certainly are many differences. I think the main issue is how to be more personal with a young lady without crossing the border into something which touches upon intimacy. And it's very hard in this. I don't know how to answer the question. Maybe Dr. Palkowitz will have some suggestions about that. That's a very, very fuzzy border between being personal, being real, showing care and concern, and then crossing over to something that is already entering to that zone of intimacy, which is inappropriate for a Yirei Shamayim. I don't...
What's wrong with intimacy? I'm not going to ask you what is intimacy, because I feel like it's like you said, but like, just maybe it'll help us understand what is intimacy, understanding what's inappropriate about going to the point of intimacy. And I'm not talking about physical.
No, of course, I understand. Dr. Pelgas, when you want to.
It's, you were asking about the Jewish perspective, right?
Yeah.
So I can speak to the... We have, you know, we have the Jewish perspective here. I can speak to the psychological perspective, which is about a little bit about gender, the gender differences that are very profound in terms, as you're saying, in a different way between men and women talk about difficult topics. There's even a different physiologic response. 80% of the time when a man talks about a difficult topic, it actually is physiologically arousing him. His blood pressure goes up, his pulse rate goes up. The woman, the more she talks about difficult topics, the more chilled out she becomes. So literally what's calming for the woman is often upsetting for the man. Just when you set people up with biofeedback equipment as they talk. So there's a profound difference even at a physiologic level. But I think that as just a general rule of thumb, it's just pushing it to the next level. To know that you're going beyond cocktail party conversation. Better way of putting it, kiddush talk. How do you talk to somebody at kiddush in shul? Everybody's gathering around, having, you know, kiddush, Shabbos after davening, and you're having just sort of like, you know, or, you know, simple living room conversations when you're getting together. To push yourself to go to the next level where you internally feel that you're exposing a little bit more than you're used to. Maybe you're talking at the beginnings a little bit about vulnerabilities, a little bit about something that's a little a weakness of yours. We're not talking about deep DMCs, you know, deep meaningful conversation before you're ready for it. We're talking about instead about just pushing the envelope a little beyond. And the reason for doing it, forgetting the content, the reason for doing it is because that very action, it tends to open your heart as well. Okay? It's sort of like lift tachli bayo, right? Is that what they say about humor also? Sort of like, you know, you want to put yourself in that slightly more vulnerable position. The content and the nature is going to differ for everybody in this room. Does that make sense?
100%. It's crossing over from what you think to how you feel. And when you're talking about how you feel about something, and as I was saying at the beginning, to begin to take out of that emotional suitcase some feelings, and even I think that Dr. Pelkovich is linked to this, to be able to speak about some vulnerabilities without laying yourself entirely bare, that there is intimacy in that. Whatever the definition in the dictionary is of intimacy, of course, but not, as you said, not physical, but talking about there is a feeling that she gets that this person is sharing with me something that he wouldn't talk to Stam a person about at Kiddush or anywhere else. He's sharing with me something that's deeper and that's more personal. But it's impossible to say. Everybody's different. But he's sharing something of himself that he wouldn't talk about casually with another person. I don't know if that helps.
Yeah. Okay. So I there's one here for Weinberger. There are a few here. I'll take one and then we'll go back and forth. Here's one that I imagine we should share, but here's some. The question is: should we wait until post-marriage to disclose baggage that you have, like things like bad midos, like struggles, etc.? So I'll tell you my first reaction. Somebody wants to tell me there's a difference between baggage and luggage. Okay, very big difference. Okay, having to do with something that you carry versus integrate, you know, sablanut is whatever. I won't go with that now, but I'll just say one thing on this question. It's an excellent question. I would say strongly no, absolutely not. I think that it's very important to, as you get further and further into a deepening of the relationship, she should know about your struggles. I'll tell you something that once happened with David Cohn. With David Cohn, I had to ask a Shaila, because the family wanted me to ask a Shaila. There was a guy who was going out very seriously with the woman, but he had a history of depression that he was doing great. But it was part of his life, and it was like really bad enough depression that he was on medicine for quite a number of years. And now he was doing great, and he didn't want to tell her. I felt he should, but he didn't want to tell her, and he thought the second she heard he was on medicine, she was going to break up with him. She came from a very yeshivish family. So the parents said, asked me to call Rav David for psak. So I called Rav David, who does, you know, specializes in the interface of mental health and halacha, and I told him the story. He said, I absolutely refuse to answer that shaila. He says, that's not a halacha question. He says, that's a question for you. But what he said was, it's a question for you, because he says, do you mean to tell me that it would be healthy for this boy, for this man, to go into a marriage with her not knowing the most important triumph of his life, that he overcame depression? This is an essence of who he is, of what shaped him. You have to do it. There's a beautiful word of Yerucham on Kamasa Livnas HaSapir, the Ed Mishpatim last year. He says, why? He says, Ma'in Yen Sheba Lachar Hagula. Says, God's footstool, sapphire embedded in, brick embedded in the sapphire. So Rav Yerucham says, what's that about? It's after the Gula. Manyan Shibalach Argulis. He goes on to write brilliantly. He says, when you've gone through tough times in life, you have to integrate the lesson of the brick into the sapphire. You have to do that. It's very important to understand that the nature of a marital relationship is that she has to know the essence of who you are and vice versa. You can't keep that secret till afterwards. It's just not a great way to start a marriage.
And that's connected to the question here. Two things. When, if ever, is it appropriate to talk about previous dating experience? And when, if ever, is it appropriate to discuss challenges one has had with Los Asuru? So I think that when it comes to those challenges that a person has had in his relationships with other girls or controlling himself with other young ladies, Dr. Tullis will correct me if I'm mistaken, I really don't believe that that's something that one should unpack, that one should divulge such information. For the most part, I have found that women, to a large extent, I have found over the years of counseling people, that women can't quite, the same way we don't understand them, there's something about us that it's hard for them to comprehend, which in a simple discussion of, if the young man would say to the young intended, he would say, you know, it's been very, very hard for me, Shmir Sinaim, she would think, this guy is an animal. You know how many times I've had situations where, unfortunately, it's happening now all the time, that I'll have some woman will call to tell me that she unfortunately has found something on her husband's phone, a picture of something that's inappropriate. And she's calling me like for the number of the Besdin, you know? That's it. She's done. Besdin. We're going to Besdin. So, first, of course, I express how this is horrible, this is terrible, and, you know, and hulu v'hulu. And then when it comes time for me to try to explain that for a man, not glossing over, not making excuses, he has to change that behavior and he needs to get help. But to her, he is simply an animal. Any human being that would, any self-respecting, God-fearing person who would ever look at such a picture, cannot be my husband. I can't live with such a person. It's impossible. And you might very innocently and honestly just like to report as part of opening up, and by the way, you know, this and this happened at earlier dates, and this is what I've had a struggle with for Shmir Sinaim and Shmir Sabris and so on. And you, what to you is not something which is earth-shattering, which is just part of a young man growing up in modern society. To her, that's it. We're done.
And I agree. I agree completely. This is a very common question. Anytime, and the only exception would be, I would say, is if you have a pornography addiction. So it's crossed the line from use to really addiction. What would make an addiction is that it's taking over your life. You're actually not able to go to classes and do what you have to do. You're not able. You literally need more and more of it, and it's become. You just Google definition of addiction in DSM-5, you'll see, okay? And it's pretty clear if somebody has addiction as opposed to whether or not they've been initial in this area in a way that's quite common and so much more difficult to overcome than it used to be because it's so readily accessible. It's not that we don't take it seriously. I find that the average frum woman, especially if she's had a pretty sheltered life, just cannot get it. And that leads to the next question, which is somewhat this one, and then this one is more directed towards Rav Weinberger. But this one could be for either of us, but it's very similar. How should past experiences with other girls be dealt with? What's the appropriate response? So there's two components to this. I mean, I agree completely. There's two components, which you might have to parse out a little bit. One component is, let's say you had a full-blown physical relationship with a woman, you know, a few years ago, or when you were in high school, whatever it might have been. I don't know that it's so healthy necessarily. I don't know. I'm not saying she'd lie about it. I don't know how easy it's going to be for her to get those images out of her head, especially if she knows this person. So that's one issue. But if you had a serious relationship, and you broke up for reasons having to do with incompatibilities and personalities or issues that inform what your needs are and inform what you're good at and what you're not good at and what your role was in it not working out,
that you could bring into a relationship in a way that could help inform how to make it better this time. So it depends what you're talking about. But, does this make sense?
Agreed.
One of the chaver is just giving examples of things that should be taken out of the suitcase, generating as well as examples that should be kept in the suitcase. I'm hesitant to make generalizations and to give examples because there are so many variations between one person and another in relationships, different relationships. But I think just along the lines that we're talking about and what I said before, certain challenges that you had in the home, without saying disparaging things about members of the family, but growing up and going to school and over the years, things that you've worked on and so on, to discuss more personal matters and taking out of the suitcase. That's exactly what we're discussing now. To be careful of what, if you have any, dirty laundry in that suitcase, about taking it out and whether that should ever be taken out. But as far as giving specific examples of what should be kept in or taken out, the issue of Gilui Halev is a way of responding, where two people are bouncing things off of each other, and you can have to take some cues, since many of the girls, as you were saying before, they do emote differently. In many ways, they emote differently, and you're going to have to try to take her cue to try to pick up on where she is being taking out from her emotional suitcase, that you can respond to that and take a cue from her. But I don't know about giving specific examples.
Okay, so I'll go back. One of the problems I feel is that I never truly feel I'm the person that I want to strive to be. Therefore, my personality is changing. Whenever I feel I grew. Therefore, my interests change. How do I take this into account? If I'm understanding this correctly, it's saying that you feel like you're a moving target, so that you're constantly changing and maybe growing and maybe, maybe you don't know what your core is. So there are two possibilities here. One is this: you're really not. If you feel that you're not sure because of this, where you're going to be or what you're looking for, what your goals are. And as a result, you don't even know the right kind of woman you're looking for in terms of the kind of home you want to have, the kind of relationship you want to have. Then I would take time till your personality coalesces a little more. But if you're talking about constantly striving and constantly changing, that's wonderful. I mean, that's exactly what marriage is about, that you grow together at each other's side. That you're constantly changing in terms of your spirituality, in terms of your religious growth, your personal growth. So the changing, it would be tragic if you were the same person 10 years from now as you are today. It would be tragic if you learn Parshas Tetzaveh this coming week the same way you learned it even last year. We're constantly changing. That's part of what makes, that's part of what life is about. So it depends which of these things it is. You ask yourself, do I know enough about the core of who I am that I'm able to know more or less the kind of person and family, person I want to spend my life with and the kind of family I want to have in a general way? If you can't answer yes to that question, then maybe you need a little more time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah.
The texting?
Oh.
Okay, because then Rabbi Weinberger...
So I should do the next one. Text messaging, it says, okay. Text messaging and dating. Is it harmful or beneficial? What can be done to ensure it doesn't make a relationship stale? Okay, great question. So let me tell you one study, one component of it. They take a group of fourth grade girls and they do something really upsetting to them, really upsetting to these girls. Mildly upsetting. And they all are given cell phones. Half are asked to text their mothers for emotional support, and half are asked to call their mother for emotional support. They then measure the physiologic responsiveness to the texting messages that their mothers text them, or the soothing voice of their mother. They look at cortisol levels, they look at blood pressure, pulse rate, galvanic skin response. They look at it in really fancy ways. Turns out, the soothing voice of a mother totally chills the girls out. They're their cortisol levels go back to normal, all the measures of stress normalize. The text, the very same words on text, does absolutely nothing. So the first thing you need to know is texting is a cold medium. It doesn't involve the kamayim apanim elpanim. It's great in order to say, hey, look, I'm a little late, there's ice on the road, maybe I'll take the train instead of driving. It's good for, it may even be good at a certain point to deepen the relationship, but it can't be the primary method. In the most recent research, they're showing that you're more likely on texting to be a little bit cruel, it's easier for it to be misunderstood, and that if you really want to have a true connection, it has to include eye to eye. It has to include mirror neuron to mirror neuron. You know, that seems to be extremely essential. The Pnei Mishalachav, it's really essential. So if you want to deepen a relationship, again, there might be a place for texting once you're already there. But the main, and I know that nowadays things have changed and people aren't so comfortable talking on the phone anymore, they prefer to text. You're gonna have to grow this way. You know, you need to have phone conversations over texting. At least that's my understanding of this. Is that?
Well, I'm watching one relationship after another go down because of this stuff. And it has nothing to do, I'm not talking about anything with Yiddishkeit or the discussions about technology. I just think exactly what Dr. Pelkovitz is saying is that it's completely unnatural. The texting can be beneficial when there's already a strong relationship and you want to send some cute little message and so on, but to develop a relationship, I'm watching one after the other. These last couple of days, a very, very big Talmud Chacham of a young man who has been, who got very quickly, this touches upon one of the other notes here, very quickly became deeply entrenched in texting and WhatsApping and all of that with the young lady, and took certain liberties that he wouldn't have taken. Crossed over certain boundaries that he never would have taken if he would be having a human conversation, and the things that did need to be discussed and should have been shared through gestures, movements, smiles, eye contact, and a kind word, a warm word. A telephone is already tremendous, you read, from a personal connection. Even when the couple's engaged, I am very, and the guys always come and say, so what's the gedarim? What are the gedarim? There's like these certain official yeshiva things to ask. So what are the gedarim? What are the gedarim? And of course the gedarim are
we don't have so many here, you're welcome to.
Yeah, they depend on common sense. But one of the main gedarim that I strongly recommend to all the guys is just texting as much as possible, stay away from that, just to notify, as Dr. Pelkovitz was saying, to notify. As far as even the telephone is concerned, of course there are times when it's impossible, because if there are different states, or in Israel, and there needs to be every now and then a longer conversation. I find that these conversations lead most often to misunderstandings, that if they would be in the same room, and they'd be talking to each other, there would be a certain energy, there'd be a certain electricity, there'd be a certain eye contact, and there would be an understanding, and a gratification of just being able to be together, instead of having to share some witticism on a text message, or on a telephone conversation. So the telephone itself is a tremendous yirida. It's unnatural. It's not how HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted and wants human beings to be able to connect to each other. To inform, yes, but not to connect, not to create a relationship. This guy, this Talmud Chacham, tremendous Talmud Chacham, a young man, tremendous Talmud Chacham. He's one after the other, and I've discussed this with him. He falls into this intense texting, quoting poems and poets and bring like complete essays and trying to win over the girls with being witty and with texting funny messages during the day, and they're just dropping him one after the other. They're dropping him one after the other. First of all, too much, too fast, too soon, and that's a major turnoff to many girls. That intensity, turning on the brights right away. A lot of girls don't like that. They want to be courted. There's still something very old-fashioned about most girls. They want to be courted. They want something that's romantic. They want something that develops and that evolves, as opposed to some guy that takes certain liberties just because it's not a conversation. So he thinks he can write anything on the text, or he can write anything on an email or something, or the Facebook, whatever other social media networking the guy is using. It is an absolutely poisonous, destructive element that I find is is really unraveling many relationships and is not allowing normal, healthy relationship to develop. I've told guys, better if you see the person once a week in person, short conversations, a little bit, how you doing, it's not over the phone, a little bit texting, just information, like Dr. Pelka was saying, the train, the car, just information, and it's exciting, and it's it adds much more mystery and excitement to the relationship to wait till the two of you are going to see each other when you go out on a date. And do not use not the telephone, not the texting, any of this stuff to develop a relationship. But delays greater, if it's some out-of-state thing, then Skyping, I guess, is better than anything else. There at least there is some sort of a punim el punim, but the texting is absolutely ridiculous.
Okay, should you tell your parents if your girlfriend is suffering from depression and anxiety? And if yes, when? And what if parents don't like her? This is the toughest one. Because it probably depends. It depends, first of all, on the level of depression and anxiety. But let me turn it on its head a little bit. You have to ask yourself, is the depression anxiety that she's suffering from, is it incapacitating? Is it a major depressive disorder? Has she had numerous recurring episodes of depression? If, in fact, that's true, then what you have to ask yourself means that she's likely going to have a lifetime of going in. She's at risk for recurring depressive episodes, although maybe not after being married. But you have to ask yourself, am I the kind of person who can handle being there for her and being patient with her and being able to really have somebody who at times is not going to be responsive to me because she just can't. She's crawling into bed. And with depression sometimes comes irritability and sometimes comes, you know, not having any interest in intimacy. And you have to really ask yourself, look close and hard in your heart to just say, am I the... Some people are. Some people are actually... do very well with people being deeply dependent on them, and they love being in that position of giving, and sometimes it could work. You have to be very honest with yourself. In terms of your parents, that's a Shiloh we have to ask for a Weinberger.
It depends on the dynamics of the family and the nature of the parents and how they would react to such a thing. In some communities, it's traditional to panic, and they're less used to and accustomed to any curveball that you'll throw them in anyway could set the whole thing off. I don't feel comfortable trying to give any sort of a clout. I deal with these things all the time, but it's one-on-one with each family depending upon what the dynamics are in the family. There might be certain things that because of your less of a lack of life's experience, you might think it's a Kleinigkeit. This is not a big deal. This is not really so important. So I would suggest that that's the kind of thing you should talk, maybe you want to first share that with somebody that you respect very deeply, a Rav, a Rebbe, a Rebbetzin, someone that has those life experiences. Before running past your parents, maybe someone who knows you and your family, it would be good to talk to them about it and to get a sense of whether they think that's the kind of, and knows your family, that's the kind of thing that could be discussed with the family. But don't just jump over right away to the parents with something that might be minor and it could blow into something major. But you should try to run it past somebody that you respect. How does one speak with a girl he likes without bordering on inappropriate flirting? The other ones, how do you express enjoying the other person? It's a very good question. It's asked all the time. Typically, a boy will ask me, am I allowed to say to the girl, I think you look nice. I think you look nice. So my first question will usually be, do you? So, oh yeah, sure, Rabbi. So I said, then you should tell her that I think you look nice. But, you know, flirting and being complimentary, it has to do with a certain kind of a person. You know, you have a certain kind of a person that if he's not Sanua, then he might say the same exact words, but it would be categorized as flirting. But another person who's more tmimizdik, and they know each other already, and they've developed somewhat of a kesher, now we're moving to the time of chiba, of showing affection, to be able to say to a young lady, I really appreciate it, the way that you dressed up, and really look so beautiful. I even though I know this is not conventional Hasidic wisdom, but I really think that you need to share those kind of things. If you're a flirtatious type of a guy, and that's not what she's looking for, she'll either slap you in the face when you say what you shouldn't, and she'll catch on very early that there's something inappropriate, and she'll be uncomfortable. She's a girl that's sana. But if you're a person that you're just complimentary, and in a tmimus dekurei, you want to tell the person how you feel that you're very happy to see that we're able to understand each other more, and I'm enjoying so much your company. And to even say things like, during the week, I think about the time that we had together, and you really look beautiful tonight. Again, I know it sounds a little bit radical, but I think that's part of the natural way that men and women court each other and are able to move forward in their relationship. I think it's healthy.
Can I just ask one? I have no right to answer on mine, but something that I find helpful is that it's very helpful in a relationship that you should all feel that you're going incrementally, like that as you're saying nice things. Let's say at the beginning of dating, to say something like, whatever the person did, if you want to compliment, it could be, if you're not comfortable saying you are so this, you could say something like, that was so thoughtful of you, make it more abstract. But then the next two or three dates, it should move more into, that was so, you know, you're so nice, or you're so thoughtful, or you're so whatever words you want to compliment. And then, as Rev Weinberger said, later on to compliment her on how she looks, obviously in a tanua way, I found that I'm sure Weinberger would agree, that it shouldn't be graphic. It shouldn't be anything that's too specific, and these are things that you will, God willing, say later on when you get married. And not something that, you know, you could tell a person she looks nice, and as Rev Weinberger correctly alluded to, in a million different ways to say it in a nice way, and then there's ways to say it in a nicer way as things go on. Something that I found very helpful in my own relationship with my husband, years and still to this day, Baruch Hashem, is that a woman wants to feel that she earned you, that she earned your affection, she earned your love, she earned your respect. It's not something like when you right away you go out with someone who's like, you're not crazy about you. Those kinds of comments should come over later, if it's because it becomes empty. It makes it as if, like, the girl, he'll like any girl, you know? Any girl that walks by, she's walking down the street, he'll like her, as opposed to something that someone earns. And also, I also thought something that my husband used to say while we were engaged that I thought was very helpful was, sometimes he would obviously, you understand Gedarim, as Rev Weinberger alluded to, I'm not a man, so you understand it better. But one of the things I thought was very, very nice and very romantic, actually, that he would say to me during our engagement was, I have so much more to say, I just can't say it yet. It made it seem like there was more to come. When when someone goes out and early on you say everything, you lay it all on, whether it's on WhatsApp or texting, or I love you, I love you, I love you, it doesn't make a person feel, not that it should be too, you know, late on in the relationship, but it's a beautiful feeling to make someone feel that things are getting better, and it's gonna climax, God willing, at your wedding, and Mer Tashem continue forever during the halachos of Hilchos Nida. It doesn't just end the day of the wedding, that's it. It goes, you know, up and down during the halachos of Taras and Mishpacha, just constantly feeling like there's more to come. There's more, the compliments get deeper, the compliments get more sincere, the compliments get more rich, because the person knows you more and more and more, as opposed to, you know, sometimes I counsel kalas who say some things to me like, he said it all, I said it all, I'm not really sure what else there is to say. And those kinds of comments are concerning sometimes, because you want to make the person feel like there's really more to go. So, as Rev Weinberger, and I'm sure Dr. Pavlos will agree, to definitely to compliment. Don't go out for, you know, many, many dates and don't say anything nice. Even something like, I had such a nice time. Or like Rev Weinberger said, to call the person and say, you know, I know you had a test today, I was thinking of you, how'd it go? Or I'm looking forward to seeing you again because you haven't seen her in a few days. There's nothing wrong with that. That's not too risque. But later on, you would say more than just that. So I just want to answer two questions that have to do with Shad Khanim, and then I'll give this back to one of the questions was, what is the shotgun's job in the beginning? I would say the shotgun's role in the beginning, whoever's setting you up. Shotgun's role in the beginning, whoever's setting you up, is just to try to communicate and give you the phone number and make sure that the first, you know, date or two, or three go nicely and that you're not comfortable telling the girl that you had a nice time or you're not sure you want to go out again, that would be the role of the shotgun. I think after a few times, it's fine to dismiss the person and say, you know, I don't like to use the word dropping the shotgun because there's some people who think that dropping the shotgun is like, it's like a stage in your relationship. That's not an impressive stage to me. To me, an impressive stage is whether you're comfortable talking to her and saying to her straight out, you know, I had a nice time, would you like to go out again? I don't know why my husband's days, he just said it like it was, and I was just, he didn't go back in the middle. He just said at the end of the day, he's like, I had a nice time, did you? So then afterwards, I said to him, what if the girl would say no? So he said, a lot of times they did say no, and I would just say, okay, then, you know, come on. I guess he would come back to the basement, or stop in Marev at the 11 o'clock Marev. I'm like, move on, you know, he just moved on. And I didn't understand why. He was just like, did you have a nice time? Yeah, okay, good, can I call you again? That was the way we used to do it back then. But that you shouldn't feel that that's such a vulnerable, terrible, yes, it is awkward, okay, but that just became awkward. It's not really awkward, it's just, you know, asking them. But feel free, you should use the shotgun at the beginning just to communicate information, just phone numbers and stuff like that. But after a while, it should get to the point where you're comfortable speaking to them. That's not to say that you could be going out with someone seriously. You could even be engaged, and you might need to call the shotgun back to ask her a certain question that you feel like you're not so comfortable asking the girl directly. You could definitely use them, but it should be that you feel more comfortable speaking to the girl later on in the relationship. And one more question that somebody asked a question. If I've gone out a bunch of times with people suggested by friends or brothers, I assume they are more successful than the shotgun. Should I use a shotgun or keep on going with these suggestions? So my answer to this question of whether should you get suggestions from friends or brothers or sisters or should you get suggestions from an official shotgun, my strong feeling on this topic is definitely show a lot of hakaras hatov to whoever is the shaliach that makes your shidduch, but don't get focused on who's suggesting the match. Focus on who are they suggesting. Like, listen to the person. When they're suggesting their sister or their cousin or their friend or a shotgun's calling you with an idea, don't get focused on, I can't believe she's calling me, she doesn't really know me, she never really met me. Listen to who they are suggesting. The person they are suggesting is much more important than who is the suggester. And again, when, God willing, that works out, whichever relationship works out, make sure you think the person, the shadchan, correctly. But okay. With that, I know there's two more questions. Okay.
What do we do about that pink elephant issue where we want to both think and not think at the same time? Good question. So yeah, and I guess this will end with this and with the next question. That's basically the challenge. The idea, part of it is, you know, the Gemara about Rabbi Akiva and Mizdamin Lo Daf. He was in a shipwreck, and he said that any time he rode the wave, so Rabbi Akiva rode the wave, that's how he survived. That's often used as a metaphor for how to deal with these things. It's to develop a mindset that when the pink elephant comes into your head, you separate it out. You put it into a parking lot. You ride the wave. You just sort of say, okay, I'm overthinking this. Let me just put it somewhere else. I can handle it. And then you go back to the business of just being as opposed to doing. So it's really about changing your relationship to the thinking. I know that sounds a little abstract, but that's what we do in therapy a lot with somebody who's, you know, who has a real problem in this area, is we develop, it's a skill that you could develop with time, where you learn how to take the pink elephant. You don't fight the pink elephant, because the more you fight it, the bigger the pink elephant will get. The pinker and the bigger, okay? Instead, if you just take it and you put them up in a little, you know, split-screen TV corner of your head, and you ride that wave, and instead the main screen becomes what you're the being is opposed to doing, you develop that skill with time. Okay.
And I guess the last question, when determining if we should go out with a girl, should we take into account her past, like high school and seminary, or should we just look at her based on the here and now? It's a very good question. We could all talk about it.
Sarah Shum, right?
Yeah. So how would you like to be judged? I think that's the same way that somebody else should be judged. As far as what way did her past experiences in high school and the seminary contribute to who she is now, it's a process of maturing. And there's no question that the main thing is Basher Husham, and the way that she reflects back on the past. We all did a lot of goofy things. I'm not talking about, God forbid, something off the chart. We did silly things. And what you want to know is, from her perspective now, of who she is now, how does she reflect upon the past? How did she draw out those good things from the past that helped to grow into who she is now? But as far as any silliness, or as far as high school and the seminary, mostly this is unimportant. It's not significant. Just to get a sense of who she is now and how she reflects upon the past and how she envisions the future.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.